What were you doing February 7th, 2014? Was it a weekday or a weekend? Did you meet friends? Pay bills? What did you do for dinner? 4 years is a long time to remember something, but I have an idea what you might have been doing. Watching the opening ceremonies to the Sochi Winter Olympics.
Athletes, officials, spectators and fans around our globe, I say, enjoy the Olympic Winter Games in Sochi 2014.
Our lives are busy, and in the intervening time, I'm sure you haven't been closely following your favorite speed skaters or checking in on the luge circuit. You may know almost nothing about the events, except they take place in the cold. That's why this episode of The Narrative is dedicated to reminding you what the Winter Games has to offer, and more importantly, to give you an appreciation of the events. Let the fuller understanding of the event's history and strategy deepen your enjoyment of the sports that come into your life once every 4 years. This is The Narrative. I'm Harry Swartout. The first Winter Olympics were held in Chamonix, France, in 1924. There were only 16 events at the inaugural games, and two were Frankensteined into a third, Nordic Combined.
So Nordic Combined is actually an original Olympic discipline. It was contested for the first time at the original Olympic Games in 1924.
That's Billy DeMong, five-time Olympian in Nordic Combined.
In the beginning, it actually took the score from the jumping, and also the race from the cross country. And there was a calculation to add those two. So there were people that competed only in jumping, only in cross country, but they combined the scores to figure out who was actually the best at doing both disciplines.
From a simple addition exercise in combining the scores of two events, the sport began to specialize. Modern Nordic Combined has a unique format that sets up for non-stop excitement.
And in modern day Nordic Combined, that is contested in not only one day, but usually in the span of a couple hours. And the way it's contested is everybody in the competition takes one jump, and then the winner of the jumping starts first in a 10-kilometer pursuit race. And depending on your distance and score in the ski jumping, you get a handicap of time. And actually, the really exciting part of that is the first person across the finish line of the cross country wins the Nordic Combined.
No messing with times or points. Cross the finish line first, win the event. But as is the case with many simple events, there are leagues of depth in the detail. Take the equipment.
So the jumping skis are really built to be like wings. They can be anywhere from 7 to 8.5 feet long. They're very wide, and they really have one purpose, which is to go straight down the end run, accumulate as much velocity as possible, and then act as wings. So they're actually tuned to respond to the athlete's technique and create lift in the jump. By comparison, the cross-country skis are really narrow. They're not nearly as long, and the cross-country skis also have a considerable amount of bend or camber to support the weight of the cross-country skier and to carry them swiftly up and downhill. And yet the Nordic Combined skier not only has to be able to be competent with each set of equipment, they have to drag all this around the world. I'm here at the World Cup in Seefeld, Austria with the U.S. Nordic Combined team. Each one of those athletes is going to travel to Pyeongchang with a minimum of 2 pairs of jump skis and also up to 20 or 30 pairs of cross-country skis per athlete for various conditions.
The equipment has to be precise because Nordic Combined leaves no room for error. Each athlete has one chance to jump almost 450 feet, so they have to be perfect. The cross-country course climbs 6 kilometers and features sprints, pelotons, and drafting like you'd see in a cycling race. It takes a special kind of athlete.
These athletes are extremely unique in the physical attributes that they've been training for decades. They've not only taught their bodies to be the endurance machines amongst the best in the world, but they also have the capacity and ability to jump extremely high. Those two things, just you're tearing one down to make the other. They really are one of the ultimate athletes.
From steep ramps and high climbs, we go to a flat sheet. Figure skating, like Nordic combined, was an event at the first Winter Olympic Games in Chamonix, but that's pretty much where the similarities end. Unlike Nordic combined, which basically arose in its final form, modern figure skating has changed drastically through the years.
Figure skating made it to the first games through these pioneers who created figures, which is where the term figure skating came from.
That's Jackie Wong, figure skating analyst and host of the Ice Talk podcast.
Figures are literally movements on the ice that create shapes on the ice.
Anja Henning of Norway executes a sweeping change foot spin, and the grace and accuracy of the champion is evident.
So the kind of the most famous thing, I guess, is the figure eight, where you literally are taking one movement and creating the number eight on the ice. And then there's this free skating part of it, where the jumps and the music and the choreography came into play. Eventually, compulsory figures became left off of actual figure skating competition. So starting in 1992, that was when there was no more figures in figure skating at the Olympics.
Jumping took over for figures thanks to some key advances in skate technology. Multi-layer leather boots gave way to lighter boots made out of synthetic materials. The blades went through an even more dramatic change.
There was this revolution in the way that people actually created the blade. So instead of it being just one knife edge, it's actually two edges that is connected by this kind of upward U-curve, which is called the rocker. So if you flip the blade over, you actually see two edges, what we call the outside edge and the inside edge.
In skating, edges are everything. When a skater jumps, all the velocity and torque of this spin and leap are transferred to the ice through the edge when they land. Miss your edge, and you could come crashing to the ice. The judges aren't going to like that. They're grading a lot of elements.
There's the triple loop. I just flipped off the end of that.
You're grading elements by how well they're executed. So each element has a base value. So a triple lutz, for example, has a 6.0 base value. If you complete that element, you get a base value of 6.0, and then the quality with which you do the element, whether you landed it cleanly, whether you stepped out of it, whether you touch your hand down, affects what the final score is based on that anchor of the 6.0 base value. And so all of the technical elements, the jumps, the spins, the step sequences, the choreographic sequences, all of those have a base value that becomes judged element by element, and that creates this technical score. Components score is the remnants of what used to be called the, you know, artistic impression mark or the presentation mark. There are five marks that talk about how well your skating skills are, what the level of transitions between elements you have, the performance and execution, the choreography, the interpretation.
And judging used to be even more complicated than that. Until 2006, skating was judged on a 6.0 system that left most scores shrouded in a veil of subjectivity. After a 2003 judging scandal, the Olympics adopted the new scale for clarity. There are still legal things that you can do to help sway the judges, though.
So much of figure skating, especially at the Olympics, is about feeding off the audience. You in the audience, as a judge, as a spectator, as a viewer on television, soak up that program as if you were just kind of immersed in the piece of art. Every single Olympic champion you've ever seen has kind of created this intangible magic with the audience because, one, they've skated a clean program, and two, they have just been feeding off the energy of the audience, and the program builds to a point where you can't do anything but stand up and applaud. And that's really how you get to that Olympic gold.
Spins on flat ice are good, but how about we take these athletes off some sweet jumps?
Everything on. Oh, there's a triple!
Yes, Gus!
Gus Kenworthy putting down the switch triple rodeo!
Free skiing is a relative newcomer to the Olympics, making its first appearance as a medal event in 1992. If you're looking for something more punk rock, this is it.
That's how I got into it, was my older brother was into punk music, skateboarding, surfing, and skiing.
That's Johnny Mosley, 1998 Olympic mogul skiing gold medalist.
And one, you know, what was happening in skiing in the 80s was, early 80s, was freestyle skiing. What was really happening was Hot Dog the Movie in Squaw Valley and skiing moguls and doing tricks and doing flips, and then ballet skiing, which was like basically showing off all these surface tricks. And it had a correlation to sort of punk music of the day. And that's, you know, when my brother saw that, he was like, bam, that's what I want to do on skis. I want to, you know, do more of like what I do on a skateboard, which is learn tricks and do tricks and try to, you know, push the boundaries. And you know, you even saw it in like Brad Holmes, and even Sean Palmer was a freestyle skier. Glenn Plake, those guys all started out as, you know, mogul skiers and ballet skiers and aerialists, and literally had mohawks, and it was the scene.
Like the punks refused to conform to mainstream music, the free skiers didn't want to conform to the finely tuned races and rigid ski jumps popular at the time. Instead, they invented tricks. The bigger, the better. And they had three different events to express themselves.
So it's kind of tricky, because in the Olympics, they refer to everything as freestyle. Now, freestyle is really originally refers to moguls, aerials, and ballet skiing. Now, free skiing, it refers to slopestyle and half-pipe skiing. Half-pipe, it's, you know, what you see really derived from skateboarding and snowboarding. It's a half-pipe, you ski down, it's on an angle, you do a series of hits, maybe five or six different tricks. Slopestyle is exactly like street skating, where you have a series of features from rails to big jumps, and you know, you link them together, and your degree of difficulty is important, and your amplitude, and how high you go and how big you go.
As they developed their craft, ripping off tricks from snowboarders and skateboarders, free skiers began to go big and get hurt. Lodges weren't on board with so many injuries on their slopes.
It hit a sort of wall because people at ski resorts were getting injured. Not only the competitors, but people going out there and just emulating the pros were trying to throw flips on the mountain, and there was lots of lawsuits. And the ski resorts basically shut it down. They said, we can't have freestyle skiing. We don't want it here. And they basically, you know, shut the whole sport down. And the International Skiing Federation basically came in, and they obviously are known for, you know, the Alpine Skiing World Cup Tour, said, we can build this sport back up. They went to the ski resorts and said, look, we can organize it in such a fashion that it'll be safe. We'll put regulations on it and rules, and the insurance companies, you know, will once again allow you to have these events at the resort. So in some ways, the International Skiing Federation came in, from my understanding, and kind of saved the sport of freestyle skiing.
While convention may have saved free skiing from an early demise, ingenuity is what makes it special. The Olympics are a chance for skiers to debut new moves and wow the judges as well as the fans with some jaw-droppingly fresh tricks.
Doing what was done before is not winning. You know, a perfect run, everyone will stand back and know that that was the winning run. They'll go, whoa! They had seen something that really impress them. And that's at the heart of freestyle skiing and free skiing. I mean, you can get crazy technical with everything, but in the end of the day, you want to run that people are like on the edge of their seat. You want to be a little bit loose and out of control, on the edge of out of control, but not out of control. You know, you kind of know when you see something good.
In free skiing, you know it when you see it. Curling? Not so much. Curling is a relatively new sport to the Olympics as well, debuting at the same time as free skiing in 1998. But the sport has been around for centuries on Scottish lochs and Canadian ponds, which might explain some of the sport's idiosyncrasies.
That's kind of an interesting question as to where it actually started and how it was formed.
That's Warren Hansen, a curling legend who's worked with Curling Canada and is currently working with USA Curling.
It was played on the on the ponds and the moors in Scotland, and initially they virtually, the initial rocks are very crude devices, and they virtually picked up rocks from the shore and begin to throw them down a length of ice on a pond, and found out, I guess, through whatever process that they could actually make the stones curl. And of course the brooms came in those days because it would snow and they needed the brooms to clear the path of the rock. And then of course that became more sophisticated with time as well.
Stones, ice, brooms. Before we go on, let's go over the Idiot's Guide to Curling.
The Idiot's Guide to How Curling Works real quickly is, I usually would say, it's sort of like shuffleboard on ice, and you've got two sides, and there's four players on each side, and in the course of an inning or an end, each player delivers two stones. And basically the whole concept is to try and get your rock closer to the target at the other end, which is virtually a bullseye. And at the conclusion of an inning or an end, the team that has the most stones closest to that center spot or button is able to count.
Basically, the stones are the discs, the people are the cues, and the ice is the floor of a shuffleboard game. The big difference is what gives curling its name. With a flick of the wrist, the curler can put a spin on the stone, which will give it an arcing trajectory. But there's more to the bend than just that. The ice and the broom are designed to help.
Well, a sheet of ice for curling is prepared in a very special way. Certainly if you look at it, you think it's completely flat surface like a hockey rink, but it's not. Before the game is played, a very fine spray of water called a pebble is applied by the ice technician in a very specific manner. And what we end up having is the ice has all these virtual little bumps on them. When the curling stone travels down the ice, those bumps are very important because with the bumps, the actual running edge of the stone probably has contact, we'll say, maybe with a third to 40% of the ice surface. If we took the curling rock out and put it on a flat sheet of ice with no pebble on it, we would have to really, really exert ourselves in throwing it to get it to the other end. The broom is fairly sophisticated, is actually how it's used and what it does. So the broom polishes the pebble and actually allows the stone, as it's going from end to end, to travel more freely. And because we always see the amount that the rock curls is depending upon the time it's in motion, by sweeping in front of the stone, you can increase the time it is in motion and, in fact, make it go further and get to the point that you want it to be.
It's a lot to take in, but all those elements, the stones, the ice, the brooms, and the people throwing, make curling a very strategic sport. Luckily, there's a built-in guide to help newcomers better understand it.
Enough, we can maybe even bump a touch.
I think freeze is good, isn't it?
Freeze is good, but we can afford to be there.
We can never make it underneath.
That look good?
One of the very important things with curling that sets it aside from other sports when you're watching on television is all the players are mic'd with radio frequency mics. So you can virtually hear every word they are saying. So as you're sitting in your living room and watching the game being played, when the players are discussing what they're going to do in each shot or what just maybe happened in the last one, you can hear it. So if you listen carefully, you can quickly pick up on what is going on and why they're doing various things, which makes it very, very unique, and it's one of the main attractions for television.
Good.
Pretty good.
If curling is chess, skeleton is chutes and ladders. Skeleton is the youngest Winter Olympic sport, being introduced in 2002. But it goes all the way back to mountain merchants in the 1800s.
People have been flinging themselves off hills for many, many years. People have been building tracks in order to transport goods in wintry areas for a long time. But they started using metal sleds, I believe, around 1892.
That's Bree Schaff, former bobsled and skeleton pilot and current coach.
As we are prone to do, humans are competitive, and so at some point, someone said, I bet I can get my stuff down faster than you, and suddenly we're racing. And, you know, that's where this modern sport that's gotten super expensive and down to the hundredth was born out of.
Skeleton differs from other sled sports because, unlike bobsled, it's an individual event. And unlike luge, where you're positioned feet first, skeleton pilots careen down the track face first. And somehow, the key to the sport is to relax.
Relaxation. That is going to trump everything. It's relaxation under mayhem. It's extremely violent conditions, and a really important part of the sport is to be one with your sled. If you have forces that are fighting and going anywhere but down the hill, that kills your velocity. So you can have a blazing fast start, but if your muscles are tight, that's all input on the sled, and that's going to slow you down. It's the ultimate Zen sport under super violent conditions.
The sled reacts to tension because it's built to be incredibly sensitive. With hyper-lightweight helmets and bodysuits, the only input into the sled is the pilot themselves. And it doesn't take much.
So a skeleton sled is a fiberglass pod that's attached to a metal frame. And the frame is designed to flex in a certain way so that when you steer, aka you press your shoulder or your knees into the sled, that's going to flex it diagonally and press the spine, which is the runner. That's the steel that you attach underneath the sled. But under G-force and speed, it's pressed into the ice so that then you can choose to engage that steering, that spine, when you want to. You think about the aerodynamics over the course of a mile, every little thing you do with your body and your head and even your mind. Oftentimes, I talk to the athletes I coach about using the force in certain corners and just willing yourself to an entrance, because that has all these little tiny muscles working you over there.
You can steer using the force, but ultimately, the best skeleton runs are the ones where pilots steer the least.
All you have is the velocity you start with. There's no engine, there's nothing propelling you other than the push at the start. And from there, it's just about minimalizing speed loss down the track with the less. It's a great example of minimal effective dose. If you can get on that perfect line with the least amount of steering, in the most relaxed way, that's who's going to be fastest down the ice. If you push your knee down and you're going 80 miles an hour, if I push it down for 1 second, that's going to be maybe 8 meters of a track because you're going that fast. So if the spot, if the sweet spot of that corner is 1 meter and some guy can hit it so precisely that it's only that he only has to touch the sled at that spot to hit that line, that's going to be much faster than the person that drags their toe or has to do that whole steer for 8 meters. It's like hitting the brakes.
There are times to press the brake, though. If a skeleton pilot is going too fast and leaves the track, well, you can't steer in the air. Expect some pilots to take off in Pyeongchang.
They will have more experience there. Whoa, crash.
It's gonna be a stunt show for sure, because this particular section of the track is very, very tricky. And the way this certain corner is shaped, it sets into a straightaway that's not straight. And not only is the straightaway not straight, it goes uphill, and then as this next big corner is coming, it drops off completely. So we call that negative G-force. So if you're pressureless, the only time you can steer a sled really is if you're under G-force. And so this section is where athletes are going to fly up, and if they're on the left side, that means they're going to hit a ton of air and then plant late into the next corner and kill all of their speed. That could be the do or die section of this track, is going from curve 9. They call this bend away 10 and 11, and then curve 12 is a big left in Pyeongchang.
With skeleton, it's learning to relax under pressure. Curling is chess on ice. Free skiing is a little punk rock. Figure skating lives on the edge, and Nordic combined demands balance. The whens and hows of the Winter Olympics can be refreshed every 4 years. But the constant in between the games is the athlete's ultimate dedication to training. The why of the Winter Olympics isn't money. It's the joy of competition.
Most of the athletes that you see at the games, a lot of them are funding themselves. So these are purely for the love of the sports, the ones you only see every 4 years, you know, when there's crickets around and then suddenly everyone's watching again. You know, you're seeing sport at its purest, the people that do it because, you know, they love it and maybe they're a little bit crazy.
Special thanks for this episode of The Narrative goes out to Bree Schaaf, Johnny Mosley, Jackie Wong, Warren Hansen, Billy DeMong, U.S. Ski and Snowboarding, U.S. Figure Skating, USA Bobsled and Skeleton, and USA Curling. If you like the show, please give us a rating and a review. Feedback not only lets us know you're out there, but helps other people find the show. Or hey, you could always just tell a friend. You can tweet about the show using the hashtag SINarrative. I'm at Harry Swarta on Twitter. And for more on the Winter Olympics and all narratives moving the world of sport, log on to si.com.